New York Times bestselling author Jeff Perlman, who's written about Walter Payton, Barry Bonds, and Roger Clemens, among others, has tackled another great sports figure. His work on Pro Football Hall of Fame quarterback Brett Favre is called Gunslinger. Jeff, thanks so much for joining the show, and I'll start with that title. Gunslinger, as you point out throughout the book, is really an apt description for him both on the field and off of it.
I think so, and he was called it a million times. You know, he just kind of lived this real, first of all, as a football player, clearly, I mean, rolling left, throwing right, throwing in the double coverage, throwing a really boneheaded interception. Now your team is down by six with a minute left. You're back on the field. You know, you tell Sterling Sharp to go deep. you wing it up there and you place it perfectly. I mean, that was covered in mud. Your wrist is bloody. And that was kind of him. So, you know, and off the field, he kind of, for a long time, lived this kind of wild and crazy life. You know, a lot of partying, hard drinking, Vicodin. It's actually funny. I suggested the title. I was thinking of the title, and then my editor at Houghton Mifflin one day was like, I was thinking of a title, and I said, Gunslinger? And she said, yeah, how do you know? And I was like, because it just makes sense. So we actually both had the same title in mind, and we barely knew each other, so it was kind of funny. Mm-hmm.
That kind of gunslinger mentality, probably that's what made him so likable, not just with Packer fans, but fans, football fans in general, and the media. He never held anything close to the vest. I think from a football perspective, if you're conservative and lose, you look a lot worse than if you go for it, kind of in a way that borders on careless and lose, kind of like a modern-day Ken Stabler, maybe. He was daring, and often, and more often than not, those risks worked for him.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, and kind of the good thing is, a lot of times they did not. You know, like, he made a lot of really stupid throws. I mean, he had a ton of interceptions in his career, and I think, like, I would say, like, in promoting this book, I've talked a lot about where does Brett Favre rank among the all-time great quarterbacks. I am not even sure he's top 10, to be totally honest. I think I can name 10 quarterbacks who are probably better than Brett Favre if you go on all the measurables. But not all the measurables. He had an incredibly strong arm. I just mean as far as overall best quarterbacks, I don't know if he's top 10. If you say to me, great quarterbacks, most entertaining, he's number one with a bullet. Mm-hmm. I mean, who is more entertaining than Brett Favre? For that long of a time period, you know, there were guys who won more. There were guys who were more exciting for brief periods. I mean, Michael Vick for a couple of years in Atlanta was just a bolt of lightning, right? Randall Cunningham in Philly was amazing, but those guys didn't last long at that level. This guy played for 20 years, you know, and always had that sort of high level of skill and also adventure.
Of all the relationships he had, the most noted one was with his father, Irv, who was his high school coach. How did that relationship and the personality of his dad shape Brett moving forward through his adult life?
Well, usually, you know, his dad was a tough, tough guy. His dad, you know, there's a story from when Brett was young and his dad were working on the roof of their house, and he fell off the roof onto a concrete slab head first, bleeding out of his head. Refuses to go to a doctor. That was this Tim guy. Never went to the doctor. Hated shots, actually. It's kind of funny. Never went to the doctor. It's kind of cliche, but he was a dad who never, he couldn't say I love you, couldn't show real emotion. This wasn't that guy. I wasn't, you know, mushy and wouldn't coddle you. And that wasn't so great. You know, sometimes your kids need to be coddled and told that you love them. But he was hardcore about being tough, about being resilient, about not taking any crap. He was Brett's coach in high school. Brett missed his sophomore year of mono, played his junior and senior year. It's a weird thing. People praise Irv Favre for coaching Brett, and yet he had his son throw about five times a game. So Brett never threw the ball. So he almost went completely ignored. I mean, he got lucky that Southern Miss even found him, because otherwise he'd be probably working at you know, some accounting firm or whatever he'd end up doing, but he just got lucky and was found. But his dad was a great high school coach. He did not fully recognize the talent of his son.
Yeah, I was going to say, he went to Southern Miss without much fanfare. He was quite a ways down on the depth chart, but really his legend began, I believe, with a game against Tulane.
Well, all right, so it's important to say this. I always make this point. He didn't go to Southern Miss with not a lot of fanfare. He went to Southern Miss with literally zero fanfare. You could not be Brett Favre was, as if you discount Southern Miss, Brett Favre was as recruited to go play college football as you and I were. I'm not even just saying that. He literally was as recruited as you and I were to play college football. He was on zero maps, zero radars. He never threw. So who recruits a high school quarterback who doesn't throw the ball? And he got really lucky. Southern Miss had a coach, and he was new, named Mark McHale. And McHale came on late in the recruiting season. He was given this territory in Mississippi by the Gulf. And he's looking around for people, and he's already been beaten by all these other schools. And he asked a coach, he said, is there anyone around here, maybe, you know, Ultra Lightning, someone? And the guy said, well, there's this quarterback at Hancock North Central, and he never throws the ball, but the kid has a gun. So he just, you know, on a lark, went to visit, watched a game, Brett didn't throw, went into another game, Brett didn't throw, but he saw him throwing on the sidelines, and he saw him make one or two throws in the game where he was just like, whoa, this guy has a nuclear cannon. So there were no scholarships left at Southern Miss. A linebacker out of Georgia backed out at the last minute. There was one scholarship on the last day. Jim Carmody, the coach, had at Southern Miss, at the last minute was like, you know what, we'll take that kid. We can always play him at safety or maybe linebacker. And that is the only reason Brett Favre went to play college football anywhere.
Mm-hmm. I guess if he was a quarterback who didn't throw, I guess he could have made it today in the Naval Academy.
Yeah, maybe, right? You know. I mean, back when I was in college, I went to the University of Delaware, and they ran the wing T.
Yeah.
He would have been an interesting wing T quarterback because he was actually really quick. But anyway, it worked out okay for the guy.
It did. One thing I didn't know, or perhaps I had heard it about it before, but I really didn't delve into the details until reading your book, was the car accident that he had before his senior season in 1990, in which he was pretty much close to death, and several of his family members thought he had died.
Oh, it's an amazing story. He was driving back, drank too much, got in this accident, had 30 inches of his intestine removed, was definitely going to miss his senior season. There was no doubt about it. He was going to have to miss his senior season. And then he sort of shocks everyone and comes back, but then he suffers an infection. Mm. And they're like, well, now he's really going to miss his senior season. And Southern Miss opens up that year against Delta State, a Division II school, and they barely squeak by. I think they won 12-9 over Delta State. And the same quarterback was going to start, John Whitcomb, was going to start against Alabama. I mean, they were just going to get annihilated. It was the second game of the season. It was Alabama's opener at Legion Field. Gene Stallings, his first game as a head coach at Alabama. And late in the week, Brett Favre is announced as a starter. And he's 30 pounds underweight. Weak. And he goes out there. He doesn't have an amazing game, but he's there. And they beat Alabama at Legion Field. And when the game ends, the coach at Southern Miss was Curly Holman, and Gene Stallings, the coach at Alabama, comes up to him and says, at the end of the game, they shake hands, and he says, hey, I hope your quarterback's okay. And Curly Holman says, our quarterback is just fine. And, you know, the rest is kind of history.
Yeah, and then he goes to the NFL, and here comes the season with the Atlanta Falcons, which everyone forgets about. So adding to the things I learned through reading the book was that rookie season with Atlanta. I figured it was a pretty uneventful one, considering he was a backup, hardly got any playing time. But we find out that it was anything but ordinary.
I love that season. It's my favorite season of his career. It's funny, because he wrote an autobiography after they won the Super Bowl, and he gave 9 paragraphs to Atlanta, and 2 of those paragraphs were single sentences. So he gave almost nothing to Atlanta. And you look at it, it's really amazing. Number one, he was a second-round draft pick. He should have been a first-round pick. He thought he should have been a first-round pick. The 2 guy quarterbacks picked ahead of him were Dan McGuire and Todd Marinovich, both pretty big busts. He goes to Atlanta. The coach, Jerry Glanville, didn't want him. He wanted Browning Nagel out of Louisville. So Favre shows up for his first day after holding out, so that really pissed off Glanville. And he shows up for his first day, and Glanville says, hey, Mississippi. And the kid says, yes, coach. And he says, let me ask you a question. What college did you go to? And Favre says, Southern Miss, sir. Jesus Christ, I wanted the quarterback from Mississippi State. We got the wrong kid. And, you know, Favre's just devastated. You know, he's really devastated. And he's, you know, he's ready for that season to be Chris Miller's backup. And they end up trading for another quarterback named Billy Joe Tolliver, the Chargers. And Favre is sent down the third string. And he basically devotes the rest of that season to drinking and eating. And he gets fat, He shows up drunk. He's out partying all the time in Atlanta. And toward the end of the year, they have the team picture. And Favre is hungover, and he misses the team picture. And he shows up late, and he pulls into the parking lot. And he says, "Coach, I'm so sorry. I was stuck behind a train wreck." And Glanville says, "Son, you are the train wreck." And that, those words, I feel like they sum up the Favre Atlanta year. He was a train wreck in Atlanta.
Well, he moved on, got traded to the Packers prior to the 1992 season, where he's a backup again. But after subbing in for Don Majkowski and leading the team to victory, I think it was against the Bengals, he pretty much had the starting gig from there and then for the next, 16 years. His first coach there, Mike Holmgren, formerly with San Francisco, was used to dealing with the attentive and straight-laced quarterbacks like Joe Montana and Steve Young. Now he's got the polar opposite in Brett Favre. Obviously, it turned out to be a successful relationship. How was it between Holmgren and Favre at the start?
It was crazy. It really was. It's unlike any relationship you'll find between quarterback coach. It was very love, not love-hate, but love-irritate. You know, Holmgren would say something, Favre would do the exact opposite. You know, Holmgren would design a play, you're going to roll right, you're going to do this. He would throw into double coverage and throw an interception. Second year, Mark Brunell comes along as a backup. He's drafted at University of Washington. And Holmgren almost benches Favre for Brunell and even asks his coaches to vote on the idea. He had 13 coaches and 10 of them voted for Brunell to start over Favre. And Holmgren at the last minute was like, you know what? He called Favre in. He's like, these guys don't think you should start. I'm not even sure you should start, but I'm making a decision here. I'm sticking with you. It's sink or swim for both of us. This is either going to lead us to the Super Bowl or basically get us both fired. And, Holmgren kind of adapted to Favre, and Favre kind of adapted to Holmgren. Holmgren found Favre very amusing, which he was. Favre knew what he was, and he knew what he wasn't. And he knew he needed discipline, and he needed structure, and he needed a little more orderliness, if that's a word, in his quarterbacking. And Holmgren knew this isn't Joe Montana, this isn't Steve Young. This is a guy who's going to freelance a lot, and I have to allow that to a certain degree. So it was a really good marriage of coach-quarterback.
Bennett, the lone setback. Two tight ends set up for the Packers, and Favre back to throw his first one. Going deep, has a man open. Andre Rison does the dance in, and Favre got settled down in a hurry.
That is a way to settle down. You know, sometimes you have to start with short passes. I always said when you got a strong-arm guy and you want to settle him down and he's anxious, just show it. Throw a deep one. That's exactly what they did. Here's Andre Rison. He's in the slot. He's going to come up against Otis Smith there. He just makes a good, quick move to the post, just runs right by him. Brett Favre throws a perfect pass.
You consider the Super Bowl win over the Patriots, the consecutive game record, the touchdowns thrown, so many thrilling regular season and playoff wins, but I think the quintessential Brett Favre moment is that Monday night in Oakland in December 2003, a day after his father passed away, in which he threw for 4 touchdowns, and it seemed like everything he put up in the air came down in the arms of a Packer receiver. I don't know about you, but that to me is what stands out, especially when you consider how important Brett's dad was in his football life.
Oh, yeah. I agree 100%. It's the game. Much more than the Super Bowl. The Super Bowl, he played okay. Mm-hmm. He didn't have the best game ever, but he played okay. And New England wasn't a great team. That game against Oakland is cinematic. You know, if someone wanted to do a movie just about that game and the lead-up to it, you could do a really good sports movie. His dad died suddenly. And Brett was crushed because, for all, his dad was a flawed man, but his dad was also his dad. And Brett was close with him, and he was kind of his role model. And he dies, and Favre finds out on a golf course in Oakland, and he's debating what to do, and he decides he's not going to play. And then he decides he is going to play, and then he decides he's not going to play. And then after meeting with a priest who he was close with, he decides he's going to play. And he has this team meeting. They have a team meeting, and Favre asks to speak to the team. And it's dead silent. And a lot of these guys have lost their fathers or their mothers or someone close to them, so people can feel this. And Favre is in front of the room, and he's crying, and he's just talking about how he loved his dad and how his dad would want him to play. But it wasn't just about that. It was about his love of football and his love for the team. And, before the game, the receivers met. And they basically, it was basically, whatever he throws up, we're getting. you know, everything you've got times 1,000. And if you look at the tape, I mean, Favre had a great game, but Javon Walker, the wide receiver, had an insane out-of-his-mind game. And it's sort of the power of loving Favre. People forget, Favre, in his prime, was an amazing teammate. And guys loved him, and they responded to him. And he wasn't just the cliche white guy from Mississippi. He was a guy who related with the white guys from Mississippi. He also related to the black guys from Detroit. He related to the black guys from Oklahoma, to the white guys from wherever. Christian, not Christian. Reggie White and him were insanely close, and they lived totally different lifestyles. Andre Rye, I mean, he had these relations with teammates that made them want to play hard for him. He was a very empathetic and understanding guy, and that goes a long way when you're a quarterback.
Well, now we're going to move on to a teammate he didn't get along with, and that was Aaron Rodgers. One of the excerpts from the book, I think this was featured on Sports Illustrated's website, is the part when Rodgers joins the Packers as a rookie from the University of California. Here was Favre, for the first time, really, having his position as the Packers' QB and leader being threatened. Rodgers, in first meeting Favre, immediately got the relationship off on a bad foot, and it kind of spiraled from there.
Yeah, well, first time he met him, he was kind of joking. He said, "Hey, Grandpa," and that's not a good way to greet your quarterback, your veteran quarterback, and the guy who's going to hopefully mentor you. And it was just really awkward, you know, because Favre had never been challenged, except for the Brunel situation. He'd never really been challenged. They always brought in, the backups they brought in were always Jim McMahon's and Ken O'Brien and David Klingler and Achilles Smith, like Doug Peterson's. They weren't going to be guys who could take the job. And here for the first time, he was a first-round draft pick on a stud who was projected to be a number one or number two overall pick. And just happened to slip and slip and slip. And Rodgers was super cocky, you know, and Favre was super protective of what he had. You know, throughout his career, Favre refused to come out of games because he remembered what happened to Don Majkowski and how he replaced Majkowski when Majkowski got hurt. So Favre was very protective of this position. And here comes this kid. He's a great arm. He's very smart. He's not a guy who's going to be like, "Mr. Favre, can I just get a minute?" You know, he was a commanding guy too. And it was an awkward, I mean, it wasn't like it divided the clubhouse. I didn't want to give that impression. It's not like the Packers were ruined because of this relationship. It was just a very uncomfortable relationship, I think, for two guys.
And Favre, I mean, as we, I don't want to bash Aaron Rodgers, but Favre really didn't help the relationship much. I mean, he wasn't really very willing to help Rodgers out when Aaron was just getting started. Is that correct?
That is. And I will say, though, I feel like people, the closer you get to sports, the more you realize this stuff happens all the time. That it's not, you know, we always talk about, the team and blah, blah, blah. Like, this is how you make your living, you know, more than anything, more than Super Bowl rings, more than the big win over the Jets. Like, this is how you make your living. And you are very protective of that. So they bring in someone to replace you. Your first sort of thought is not, I'm going to help this guy and prepare him to take my job. Like, you are going to be defensive. Most of the greats I've interviewed, dealt with, written about are very, you know, Walter Payton. I wrote a book about Walter Payton. When they drafted his replacement, he did nothing to help him. It's sort of a common theme among the greats. They are great for a reason because they hold tight to that position like they're holding a blanket. You know, like it is theirs, and you're going to have to yank it away from them. And that's sort of what it was like for him.
We've seen Brett Favre return to Lambeau Field both last Thanksgiving to have his number four retired, and just recently to have his name placed on the team's Ring of Honor, and he was cheered by the crowd on both occasions. But has Green Bay fully embraced him? Have they completely forgiven him for not just his departure, which was not particularly ceremonious, but especially by joining the rival Vikings a year later?
So I think it's 93% there. I think, you know, kind of reminds me, so I grew up in New York, and Patrick Ewing spent his last 2 years with Seattle and Orlando, right? And it's not the same thing, I'm not saying that, but it was weird, right? It was just weird to see Patrick Ewing even in a different uniform. And I remember thinking, does this mar his legacy? Like, does this change anything? And then you take a few steps away, and the years pass, and Patrick Ewing is a Nick. You know, he's just a Nick. And Brett Favre in Green Bay is a Packer. There are definitely people who have not forgiven him. I mean, he went to the Vikings to kind of stick a needle in the eye of the Packers front office, and that's why he did it. So it wasn't just a guy who was traded. It was a guy who definitely wanted to send a message and seek some revenge against his organization. now is sort of has been embraced as if he never left.
I know you had more than 500 interviews for this project. What kind of attempts did you have, did you make to contact and interview Brett Favre himself?
Well, I had three interviews lined up. First of all, I sent him a book and a letter at the start. Then I'm trying to think the order of it all. I definitely sent him a text at some point. And then I scratched a text. He texted me later on. I sent him my stuff. Then I had three interviews arranged through a website he works with called Score. And it literally was, okay, next Thursday, 8 a.m., Brett will talk to you. I call, he doesn't talk. I complain to the PR person, all right, next Thursday, it's 6 a.m., you know, blah, blah, blah. Never got it. Then, toward the end, I sent him another book. Someone told me he enjoys books on tape or audiobooks while he's mowing. So I sent him one of my books on audio, another note, and he sent me a text telling me he just decided he wasn't going to talk. So, you know, you make your effort to try your best, and sometimes people talk and sometimes they don't. I got all of his family, or almost all of his family, so that was pretty good for me.
Do you know why he was, I guess, evasive? Do you know why he never talked?
Well, I think it's not the first time I've written a book and someone won't talk. And a lot of times, people want to control the narrative. And that sounds negative, and I don't actually mean it that way. I always try to put myself in another person's shoes. You're Brett Favre. You've had this great career. You also have a lot of things, from the whole, you know, Vicodin, infidelity, the pictures when you were with the Jets, you know, the genital, whatever you want to call it, pictures.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things there. So I think you want to control the message if you want it out there at all. So someone comes along and he says, hey, I'm doing a book on your life and you have no say in it. So will you talk to me? Mm-hmm. Like, I get being on that end of it and thinking, well, I'm not making money off it. I'm not controlling the message. What's in it for me? So I think that's a pretty common thing among athletes, which I get. I totally get.
Did your perception of him change after all these interviews, all this research, from what you had known about him before starting the project?
Oh, yeah. Better. I like who he is. I think it's funny. When that excerpt ran about the Rodgers Favre stuff, people are like, God, he was kind of a jerk. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, at that point in his life, in that situation, sure. But I think he's gone through so many ups and downs, you know, like, again, car accident, Atlanta, Green Bay, the glory years, and Vicodin, going to the Jets, kind of a miserable year ending in New York, Minnesota, like, your wife almost leaving you, you know, on and on and on. And now here he is at 47, and he seems like a great dad. He's a grandfather of two. He's a volleyball dad who follows his daughter around in high school volleyball. He's a very supportive husband. I just feel like life's journey takes you to a certain place, and I sort of I like where it's taken him. He just seems like a pretty content guy in his life, which is a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the timing of the book's release, are you pleased that it's now out now, as opposed to, say, like, maybe it was done like 4 or 5 years ago? Because at least I felt this way, that we were kind of inflicted with a severe case of Brett Favre fatigue from all the retirement drama of would he retire, would he not retire.
Yeah.
Kind of now it's kind of worn off now that he's in the Hall of Fame. It's kind of he's not coming back anymore. So it's kind of all that fatigue is kind of worn away, and now it's a good time to read a book about him.
Yeah, you said that perfectly. I feel I want nothing to do with Favre when he was retired or unretired. It was so boring and so tedious, and nobody wanted, you know, it's funny. I wrote a book years ago about Roger Clemens, and it was in the midst of the steroid stuff. And the book, it was my worst selling book by far. And I just think, like, there are periods where people want nothing to do with an athlete, where the narrative has gone dry or stale. And Favre definitely, that was definitely the case with Favre during the sort of retire, not retire, retire. And I feel like now it's kind of, all right, all that has passed. We're good again. Everyone's good again. You know, he's just this great quarterback, and we're just remembering him for, you know, for the good things, more for the good things.
I want to pivot, to use a political term, to a project you're currently working on, and that's about the short-lived USFL. And quite appropriately, probably the most significant figure in the news today, well, I think he is the most significant news figure, is Donald Trump, who back then was the owner of the New Jersey Generals and had a lot to do, or probably everything to do, with the league's demise.
Yeah, that's funny, actually. That's actually, the funny thing is, it's weird timing. Everyone's like, wow, that's great timing. And I'm like, what? I just wanted to write a USFL book. You know, like, I've been wanting to write a USFL book for years and years, and nobody would give me a deal. And I finally got a book deal, and here he is running for president. And everyone's like, ah, it's too bad, the timing, because he'll, you know, he's probably going to lose, and he'll lose, and he'll be out of the news. And for me, it's great. Like, I don't want this to be a Trump book. I mean, he's certainly a big part of the USFL, for good and for bad. But I don't want it to be a Trump book. I think the league is far more interesting than one person, yeah. Even though he's a very interesting guy, obviously. So it's just weird coincidental timing.
And I think it would totally get buried by every other news bit about him. I mean, it would totally get submerged.
Right. That's how I feel. I mean, there are probably 9 books out on Donald Trump right now. You know, and also, like, I don't want people to think it is a Trump book, because it's not a Trump book. You know, the idea of writing a Donald Trump book is as appealing to me as having my eyes burned out by lasers. You know, I couldn't do it.
And
but I hope he makes America great again by doing something, by moving somewhere else. That's my kind of my hope.
You know, as you said, that the USFL was a lot more than just Donald Trump. I don't know. You may have even been involved in this. Did you see that 30 for 30 along one of the first ones?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, the guy who did it is a friend of mine, Mike Tolan. It was great. I love it.
Yeah, no, yeah. I watched that, and I got a whole new perspective on all everything that went into it. It was not just that famous lawsuit with the NFL. It was a lot more than that.
Oh, no. Man, almost 200 people went from that league to the NFL. And not just Reggie White, Steve Young, Jim Kelly, Herschel, Flutie. I could go on. Our coaches, Jim Mora, John Fox. Oh, yeah, it's the best. It's great. I don't know. I always said, like, I've written 7 books. I've enjoyed the ride immensely. I've never done a passion project before. You know, like, I've never done a book where I'm like, you know what, this might sell 20 copies, but I just love it. And hopefully my love, maybe that will carry it a little. And that's a USFL. It is completely 100% a pure labor of love.
We certainly look forward to Jeff's upcoming book on the USFL. The full title of his Favre book, which is available now, is called Gunslinger, The Remarkable, Improbable, Iconic Life of Brett Favre. You can purchase it on Amazon, among other booksellers. Be sure to download and listen to all episodes of Profiles in Sports on iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, and most other places you listen to podcasts. You can also follow the show via profilesinsports.com or on our Facebook page. And you can follow yours truly, Brian Wright, on Twitter, @BrianWright86.